Sheridan was able to turn the drone.
Well, he's a mathematician. Thank you. Okay, so as stated, I'm talking about de Sitter vacua and string theory. Let me know if it's not in focus. The work I'm talking about was jointly done with Kalash and Wende, who are at Stanford, and Trivedi, who is at TIFR in India, and appeared about a month and a half ago. Okay, as you'll see, especially in the second half of the talk, I will take you through a rather ugly and circuitous construction, so I need to provide motivations that explain to you why you're up at 8:45 to hear about this ugly and circuitous construction. So we're going to be trying to make de Sitter vacua in string theory. You might ask, what are the motivations for trying to make de Sitter vacua in string theory? Well, one is maybe we live in de Sitter space, so that's a good motivation. But there are many others. Just like quantum gravity and anti-de Sitter space taught us a lot, even though we don't presumably live in anti-de Sitter space, DS quantum gravity promises some lessons of its own. There are interesting conceptual issues related to the fact that there's an entropy, but we don't quite know what the entropy is counting in terms of microstates. We don't know what the observables are in de Sitter quantum gravity. In flat space, and to some extent in ADS space, the observables are S matrices or S matrix-like objects, but de Sitter space does not have a spatial infinity, and you can't define an S-matrix. There are issues related to Poincaré recurrences, about which I'll have more to say at the end of the talk, and the question of whether string theory has to grapple with Poincaré recurrences in de Sitter space. So real constructions might or might not shed light on these kinds of issues. And the last motivation, and this will be clearer to many of you if you don't know what I'm talking about here by the end of the talk, string theory, or M-theory, I think has a discretium of vacua. It has many, many vacua, even after supersymmetry breaking, with some dense structure. And maybe we should start coming to terms with this and figuring out what we do in high-energy physics in a situation with many, many vacua. Okay. The particular work I'm describing today has something to do with, well, constructing examples of metastable de Sitter space in type 2B string theory. So that's the first thing. Then we'll have something to say about this issue of Poincaré recurrences, both in this example and perhaps in generic stringy examples subject to some provisos. Okay. And I'll spend most of the time on this construction and then discuss this phenomenon of recurrences a little at the end, assuming there's time. Okay, so what's our strategy? Well, you probably all know about string theory on Calabi-Yau manifolds, and one of the things that Calabi-Yau manifolds are well known for is coming with plenty of moduli of the Ricci flat metric. So let's call those, or the resulting four-dimensional fields, phi sub I. Then most string compactifications we know about are plagued by the existence of these moduli fields, scalars with undetermined expectation values. And in their presence, if you want to study a theory with cosmological constant, it's more subtle than it sounds, because in physics one likes to minimize the energy. So when you try to compute a cosmological constant in string theory, what you really succeed in computing is a potential for moduli, a lambda that a priori depends on which point in this moduli space you expanded about, okay, or this approximate moduli space. So the reason that, of course, conceptually that's completely straightforward, so what? But in practice, that gives us a very hard time because in string theory we really only know how to compute around very large radius or very weak coupling, usually some extreme value of these fields phi. And so we end up with pictures that often look like this. There's a nice, well-understood vacuum at some extreme value of the fields, and as you try to leave it, you see that there's some energy, and then at any reasonable distance from this nice symmetric vacuum, you don't know what the hell happens. Okay. So in particular, trying to study vacua that could sit here at positive or sometimes even negative cosmological constant can be subtle. So to deal with these difficulties, we're going to do the following. A few years ago with Joe Polchinski and Steve Giddings, who's here, we constructed some Calabi-Yau compactifications of type 2B string theory with an important step called orientifolding, or equivalently, F-theory vacua, that had only one scalar modulus left. So this picture with many hundreds of moduli fields was simplified to a more tractable problem. There was just one field, phi, left over, or actually we called it sigma, which goes like the fourth power of some typical size scale of the Calabi-Yau. Okay. So we'll start with these models, and I'll review how you get there. But these are some particularly tractable class of studied models. Then what we're going to do is take the next logical step Those models that I studied with Steve and Joe still have this undetermined field expectation value left, but we know already a little bit about what quantum corrections to expect in string theory, so we can just incorporate the simplest known ones and see what would happen in this class of models. And already there you get a reasonably generic answer that you generate a non-zero potential for this field, but also that generically this potential has a minimum, the minimum is supersymmetric, and the minimum is anti-de Sitter. And here, we'll make use of an idea that was really popularized by Busol and Polchinski. That is, not only will you generically have this ADS minimum with supersymmetry, but by discretely fine-tuning, and I'll explain what you discretely fine-tune, it's part of the construction, you can keep yourself in a regime where you think you have some amount of control over the calculation, where some radius is large or where G-string is appropriately small. Though since there are no moduli left, it is not possible to achieve arbitrarily large radius or arbitrarily weak coupling. Then in the last step, which is required to go from the relatively pretty supersymmetric anti-de Sitter space to the ugly non-supersymmetric de Sitter vacuum, we have to use a construction I studied with Rowinda and Pearson a few years ago. You take these same geometries I studied with Joe and Steve, you incorporate this correction, and then you add one D-brain. Okay, and if this D-brain is chosen correctly in the right kind of model, its tension lifts the energy up and gives you a de Sitter space. Okay, and it's important in this last step that the constructions that I've described in the previous two steps can have significant warping. And for those of you who don't know what warping is, I'll also describe that quickly. Okay. But before we proceed, so for most of this talk, I'll be bad about references. Since I'm talking about de Sitter constructions, I should at least give some references to nice de Sitter constructions. There are a few classes. Just engage supergravity in four dimensions. Big European groups with Frey et al. And DeRue et al. Have started to show that in gauge supergravity with n equals 4 or n equals 2, they can make de Sitter minima that are stable, that have no tachyons. Okay, so the way we differ from this work is just that we're going to work in 10-dimensional string theory and compactify and worry about the dilaton and the radion, and they work directly in 4-dimensional gauge supergravity, so you'd have to derive their construction from string theory if that was your interest. Eva, along with Alex Maloney and Andy Strominger, produced some asymmetric orientifold compactivications of non-critical strings, that is, in dimensions above 10.
So are you suggesting that the uplifting to 10 dimension is not obvious in those solutions?
No, the real subtlety is the following. First, what you said, it is actually not obvious how to get that gauging out of compactification on a Calabi-Yau. But a second problem is when you do, you typically get additional fields, one of which is this dilatation mode that could make the Calabi-Yau larger. So those fields wouldn't be included in the minimal content they studied and lead to the real serious problem, which is that you might decompactify instead of sitting at the stable de Sitter vacuum.
Yeah, so their vacuum are absolutely stable. In
right.
40, yeah, so probably, well, in essence, there's a theorem that you can't completely...
That's right. The Maldesane and Nunez theorem says you would have to, you'd then add the radion would want to roll, and you'd have to fix that problem, which is what we'll be dealing with in most of this talk.
Can you just say explicitly what it is that you do that violates the
theorem? But let me say it at the end. But yes, I do know many things that we do that violate the theorem.
Well,
yeah, exactly. The theorem is a theorem about tree-level supergravity, not even including higher derivative terms that we know are present for anomaly cancellation, let alone quantum corrections. Okay. Now, I was going through previous work. So Eva, Alex, and Andy had some nice constructions in supercritical string theory. We differ from them in that we work in critical string theory, and we work it to the extent that we can at large radius as opposed to in asymmetric orbifolds. There's a third construction that we've heard a lot about at Stanford recently called the Kodama state, and I'll be using a different formalism for quantum gravity, so I differ from this in many ways. Okay, so let me start with the steps of the construction. In the first step, we consider F theory compactified on an elliptic Calabi-Yau fourfold X, which means that X is some manifold you can think of as an elliptic vibration over a three-dimensional base M. Now, the words F theory on X are, as far as I can tell, equivalent to the words we study type 2B string theory compactified on this base M, and the variation of this elliptic fiber tau as you move around, of the complex structure of the elliptic fiber tau as you move around on the base M parameterizes the variation of the type 2B axio-dilaton. So this is just type 2B string theory. Now, there's a tadpole condition, which I think in this context was actually first written down by Saab and Ed and Kamrad-Vatha, which says that the Euler character of X actually contributes negatively to the total d3 charge present in spacetime. But by Gauss's law, since the space is compact, there can't be total d3 charge, so you have to cancel it. And you can either cancel it by adding d3 brains explicitly or by turning on fluxes. Because in type 2b string theory, there's an anomalous term in the F5 transformations that says that three-form flux, H and F, can contribute three-brain charge. So the 2b theory has two three-forms, an NS three-form H and a Ramone-Ramone three-form F. And what we'll do for now is not add any three-brains and saturate this entire tadpole just with flux. Okay. So what that means is this manifold has some three cycles in the geometry, and we turn on quantized fluxes of these H and F fields. We choose integral three-forms, H and F. Now, this is just a point of language. Sen has proved quite generally, given any fourfold, it doesn't have to be an orbifold of a torus or something, that there exists an orientifold limit, suitably defined, where this F theory on X can be described as a Z2 orientifold of a Calabi-Yau. Okay? So, henceforth, I'll always abuse language and just say M is a Calabi-Yau, and we're studying a Calabi-Yau compactification of 2B string theory. But really, you should keep in mind this more general F-theory context. It's just easier for notation. Okay, and
it's not true for every N.
Given the Weierstrass form, you can actually directly prove the existence of the orientifold limit.
You get bad string variables in many cases, even in the sixth
dimension. I wouldn't disagree with that. Okay, but formally, he actually proved that you could get a limit where tau is almost constant everywhere except codimension 1, and then he tried to interpret those as codimension 1 loci as being brains. Okay. Now, in this limit, you might ask what this formula means. Well, chi of x is just counting the fact that you might have O-planes or wrapped D7 brains in the 2B geometry. The O-planes explicitly can contribute negative D charge, and the wrapped D7 brains have there are couplings on their world volume that give rise to anomalous negative D3 charge. Okay. So you can understand all of that from 2B also. Okay, but in this situation, although we have a Calabi-Yau or an orientifold of one, we've turned on H and F, these three forms, these integral three forms, and we don't get to do that for free. They generate a potential. The reason is, of course, that H and F appear in the 10-dimensional Lagrangian with H squared and F squared type terms. Okay. So in N equals 1 supergravity language, we can summarize that potential as follows. You define a complex combination G to be F minus the axial dilaton times H, and then you say the superpotential is given by integrating the wedge product of G and the holomorphic three form over the Calabi-Yau M. Okay, so this formula was first derived by these people. And if you combine that with the standard Kalor potential that would exist in this N equals 1 supersymmetric low energy theory, here I have the Kalor potential for the dilaton, here I have the Kalor potential for the complex structure moduli, which gives you the Weyl-Pedersen metric on the moduli space. And here I've assumed there's just one Kalor modulus rho, so then you get the minus 3 log form. Okay. Then the statement is, they derive this potential in a more roundabout way, but you can actually just directly prove that dimensional reduction of the G squared term in the 10-dimensional Lagrangian gives a potential energy that's equal to this expression with K and W chosen like that. So it's just algebra. Okay. Now, this expression for the potential is the standard one for N equals 1 supergravity. You have the normal dW squared terms, and then you have the minus 3W squared. But in exactly these situations where there's just one overall volume, actually this would work with more, but here is the most obvious, with this minus 3, something nice happens, which is to say that this superpotential only has explicit dependence on complex structure. So when you take the Kalor covariant derivative of this superpotential with respect to the rho field here, okay, all you get is the covariantization term, where you differentiate the Kalor potential with respect to rho, and you multiply by W. And that leads to cancellation, where the rho term here exactly cancels the 3W squared. So you just get a positive semi-definite energy, where you sum over fields except rho. And this occurrence of positive semi-definiteness, despite the fact that we're in supergravity, is a famous old fact called no-scale structure that was also exploited in the heterotic string for many years. So this is a nice, relatively geometrical potential. And if you minimize the resulting potential, what you find is generically the following. Well, the superpotential depends on all of the complex structure moduli, because it's G wedge omega, and it depends on the deleton tau, which entered in the definition of G. So what you'll find is that the complex structure moduli will be fixed, and the deleton will be fixed. Okay. And the masses that they get when I say that they're fixed, what I mean is they get a potential with a nice minimum, and the masses they get scale like alpha prime over the cube root of the, sorry, not the cube root, the cube of the size of the manifold. Now, generically in these models, supersymmetry is broken. Why is that? Well, there was one other modulus, rho. It dropped out of that potential function, but its F term, d rho of w, is k of rho times w. And if w is non-zero, then the auxiliary field in rho is non-zero, and supersymmetry is broken. Okay. And in terms of the geometry, that shows up in the following way. These equations that you get by stationarizing the G wedge omega superpotential tell you that for a solution, G should be of type 2,1 plus 0,3 in the final complex structure at which these moduli get fixed. But you preserve supersymmetry if and only if the 0,3 piece of G vanishes. Now, generically, that won't happen. You'd have to be lucky. So generically, if you evaluate W in your vacuum, it is just that 0,3 piece, and we'll call it some constant, W0. Okay. And in both of these steps, so we said the deleton gets fixed, and you get some constant piece, W0, in the potential. Both of these things, the value at which the deleton is fixed and the value of W0, vary with your fluxes. In a simple collabial, take the, I don't know, the quintic or something, you would typically have several hundred three cycles. Okay. So by moving around in this lattice of several hundred three cycles, if you want to have a certain amount of control, you could tune your fluxes to make G string small and W0 small, if you so chose. Okay, that goes along the lines of this Busso-Polchinski argument. So I'll do that to some extent just so I can draw pictures with some amount of control. So this is where I'm using this orientifold language. When I use F-theory language, then of course not. But in sense language, it would be constant except at these loci where there are thin walls, and the thin walls are known D-brains. Now, at the level of this analysis, so far what it looks like we found is supersymmetry is broken, but by this no-scale structure, there's no cosmological constant. Okay, that, of course, will not persist, and we'll get to the corrections. There's one important note here. In the F-theory or M-theory language, the 7-brain moduli of the type 2b theory, see, the 2b theory might have 7 brains. We just turned on flux, there were no 3 brains. But there could be 7 brains, and you might worry that they can move around. Okay? But in the F-theory language or M-theory language, these become explicitly complex structure moduli of the Calabi-Yau fourfold. Here I'm making one assumption that I can defend if you bother me about it later. Okay? And because of that, and because you know what generic fluxes do in F or M-theory, you can see that those moduli also get fixed. Okay? Which means at low energies, on these D7 brains, it's easy to arrange to just get pure Yang-Mills theory with n equals 1 supersymmetry. Well, it's just a Messier calculation. So an example of such a calculation was discussed in a recent paper by Trivedi and Tripathi, I think. Okay, so but you can do it. It's just Messier. Okay. So what remains at energy small compared to the scale at which the moduli got fixed, alpha prime over r cubed, is a really boring theory with just a scalar field rho and maybe some gauge fields. Okay. And then we want to characterize that by a superpotential and a Kalor potential. And to leading order, we've seen that its superpotential is just a constant, which was the 0,3 piece of G. And the Kalor potential is this tree-level Kalor potential, minus 3 log of rho minus rho bar. Okay. But, of course, I've added question marks here because we'd expect both of these to receive various kinds of corrections. Okay. Now, I should say, to this level of analysis of analyzing these flux vacua, I've done things kind of generically here, but many very concrete examples have been studied. So, for instance, if you study simple examples on T6 or K3 times T2, people have classified to some extent what the solutions are. They've seen that you can fine-tune to get actually supersymmetric solutions instead of breaking supersymmetry, also in some orbifold examples. So there's been a lot of work on fleshing that out. For more generic threefolds, other than orbifolds or K3 times T2 or tori, less is known, but the general theory is pretty straightforward. Okay. In particular, it's not known with generic threefolds whether you can ever arrange to get a supersymmetric solution, whether you can arrange for G to have vanishing 0-3 piece. But we won't need that. Okay, now I'm going to go to the second step, which is to incorporate corrections. And the punchline of the second step will be where we thought we had a Minkowski solution, we're really going to end up with a supersymmetric ADS solution. Okay, and I'll explain that in a way that makes it clear why it's generic. So first of all, I'm going to study corrections to the superpotential, and then I'll try to argue that the corrections I keep are the only ones I have to keep in suitable examples. Okay, so the first point is, well, there are only two known corrections, two known types of corrections to the superpotential in these models. Okay, one comes from infrared gauge dynamics, and the other comes from D-brain instantons. So let me discuss the infrared gauge dynamics first. Suppose we stabilized at a point in complex structure moduli space where there was non-abelian gauge dynamics. How did that come about? It must come about because there's some stack of seven brains which are wrapping a four-cycle, the same four-cycle, sitting on top of each other, and which give rise to some SUNC gauge theory, or maybe SO, but you get the idea. It's the standard non-abelian theory on a stack of brains. And if you go and look, the attainable NCs in the models that are elliptic fourfolds with H11 equal to 2, so that after the lift there's just one volume modulus, are slightly in excess of 30. So reasonably large ranks are attainable. Okay. So in this SUNC gauge theory, we know there's a gauge coupling, and it goes like the volume of the four-cycle the seven brains wrap, because there's a seven-dimensional gauge theory, you wrap it on a four-cycle, you've got a volume factor, and it's gauge coupling. So 1 over g squared goes like r to the fourth over g string in these theories, and we'll call that 2 pi m rho, or I've also called that sigma before. Okay, well, that theory, as much of our field has been studying by matrix models for the last few months, undergoes Gugino condensation. Okay, and so in the simplest case where it was just a pure SUN, with no fancy charged matter and no massive modes, the result would be a superpotential that goes like the dynamical scale of the gauge theory to the third power, which in this case would look like this. There's some coefficient here, which eventually I'll set to 1, but making it larger just helps us, and the natural values are larger. And there's this strange fractional power of e to the I 2 pi rho. The fraction is there because it's well known just in field theory that Gugino condensates aren't really instanton effects. They scale like fractional instanton effects. You cannot derive them from a real instanton calculation. Okay, that's one kind of correction you might find. There's a second kind, which is more akin to honest gauge instantons. Witten showed in 1996 that if X, the fourfold, has divisors of arithmetic genus 1, which project to four cycles in the base M, then in the F-theory limit, Euclidean D3 brains, which wrap this four cycle, can contribute a superpotential, which to leading order just scales like e to the 2 pi I rho, okay, and then would have a priori multiple covers. Just like a priori, there would be higher instant or higher exponential corrections to that. Now, in practice, either of these effects mean that it's natural to consider, in this context, the following kind of superpotential. You have a W, which is the tree-level piece that we derived, and if you find a model where either of these effects is present, this leading instanton correction, where big A is fixed by one-loop calculation, and little a is 1 over NC or 1, depending on which kind of effect you have. Okay. And then a priori, there would be higher instanton corrections. And I'll explain in a second why I'm not worrying about that.
So rho is perplexed, presumably.
That's right.
So any superpotential would have to have this form.
Yeah, I agree. Just by holomorphy.
Yeah. I mean,
I agree. Sure. I'm just explaining we actually know in these class of models what the microphysics is that would give rise. But I totally agree with that. Actually, that's how Ed argued for this form before finding the M5 brains that gave it. Okay. Now also, as you all know, the KLR potential will be corrected perturbatively even, not even by, I mean, well before you get instanton effects. Okay. In fact, the first such correction in the alpha prime expansion has been computed by these people, Becker, Squirt, Hawk, and Lewis. And so we know the form of the leading correction. And I'll argue that we don't keep these corrections because in the examples that I discuss, this leading correction, at least, is smaller than the effects that we keep. Now, if there was a coherent sum of corrections in the Kalar potential that added up order by order, I couldn't say anything about it. But we have no reason to expect such a conspiracy. So, in other words, the generic expansion parameter for corrections here doesn't look like it will overwhelm what I talk about. Okay, so I'm going to take the W of the form I just wrote down and ask the next question. So now we have this low-energy theory with a W and with just one field rho. Can we find supersymmetric vacua? Well, that's equivalent to the question, can we solve d rho of W equals 0? Okay, and, well, I'll go through it in some case, but it should be pretty clear the answer is usually yes. Okay, for simplicity, I'll ignore the axion in rho. I'll set it equal to I times sigma. Okay, so the real part I'm setting to 0. You don't have to do that. It's just for simplicity. And I'll take those parameters that appeared there all to be real and one of them to be of definite parity. Okay, but again, that's for convenience on this transparency. It's not fundamental. So if you do that, then the equation d rho w equals 0 can be solved in this way. There's a critical value of sigma at which you stationarize w, and, well, it scales like this. And if you evaluate the potential at this critical value of sigma, it turns out to be negative. That's not a surprise. Since you solve the supersymmetry equations, you have a supersymmetric vacuum. That means it's either Minkowski or ADS, and there would have to be a miracle for it to be Minkowski. So it's generically ADS. Okay. Now I should stress, so here we had some form of W that I tried to motivate, and there are some parameters that you might want to tune to keep it under control. But this generic fact that incorporating any correction will lead to an ADS vacuum is clear, because the reason before you broke supersymmetry was just that W had no dependence on rho whatsoever. Okay. As soon as there's any dependence on the last field, you're solving one complex equation with one complex variable. There's no reason you shouldn't be able to do it. So the no-scale models are very non-generic before you incorporate corrections, and that's why it's hard to preserve supersymmetry in Minkowski space. Okay, for control over this kind of calculation, what do you want? You want large radius so that you have small alpha prime corrections, and you want a sigma, this thing that appears in the exponent here, the instanton parameter or the Gugino condensate parameter, to be large so that you can use this kind of naive exponential form and not sum an entire instanton expansion. Okay, both of these are not fundamental concerns, they're just calculational concerns. That is, when can you use such a crude approximation to what's going on? Okay. And the fact is, if you stare at these equations, you can satisfy both of these criteria if you tune to make W naught modestly small. By modestly small, I mean if you have 200 fluxes, you don't need to make it 10 to the minus 200, you need to make it 10 to the minus 4. Okay, so that's something that any simple analysis shows you can quite easily do. Okay, so now this is clearly not a math talk. I'm going to now plot something. Okay, so here's a picture of the potential you get with some choices of those parameters. A has been chosen in a way that is not advantageous for us. It's just 1. Whittaway is 0.1. That is good for us, but not unreasonable given the ranks attainable. W I took to be 10 to the minus 4. Okay, again, Abuso-Polchinski analysis says that with 200 fluxes, you can do a lot better than that. So you get some nice curve. There's an ADS minimum. It's a large sigma critical. And one important point is that with these kinds of parameters, which are tuned a little bit, you have a 10th or a 10 to the minus 4, but not tuned outrageously, you do get some distance between yourself and the string scale. This is the potential times 10 to the 15th. So you don't have to worry so much about stringy effects that are mysterious. You're working well below string scale.
Would that matter?
Well, exactly. So if you had multiple factors, there's a comment about that right here. That's one thing you could mean. There's another thing you might mean. Okay. If you wanted actually to get more controlled pictures, a standard way to do it would be to do something like what you were just saying, which is to have multiple factors. And as long as the ranks are correct, you can actually make more controlled models that way. That was actually an idea explored in the late 80s in the context of the heterotic string by Krasnikov and Dixon et al., called racetrack models. Okay. Now, I'll assume that wasn't your question. There's another concern you could have, which is just multiple covers, for instance. So you might get some complicated polylogarithm of e to the I rho. Okay. And that's why I tried to impose this constraint that we want to work where A sigma is as large as we can get it. Okay? That means that if there's a sum of exponentials, unless you're very unlucky with the coefficients, the leading exponential is good enough.
So what does that mean? Physically, you want large, you want non-linear negation if you have a large rank or something?
Well, that's right. Large NC helps. Large NC and large sigma both help to do this.
It's a bit confusing.
Okay.
So you want multiple 7 rings that are coincident.
That's right.
To get this.
That's right.
In the F theory picture, you'd have
A big singularity.
A big singularity.
Absolutely.
But naively, that singularity would have modulus.
That's what I was saying before. So the 7 brains wrap a 4 cycle.
Yeah.
Okay. There are two sources of moduli for 7 brains wrapping a 4 cycle. One is Wilson lines from H1 of the 4 cycle.
Yeah.
The other is motions of the 4 cycle, which actually come from H2. Okay. Now, in models, this is a trivial point, but in models that come from toric varieties, fourfolds, you can argue in many cases that the H1 contribution is zero by using the Lefschetz hyperplane theorem. So there aren't just Wilson lines.
No, this makes sense to me when things are smooth. Doesn't make sense to me when things are single.
Well, this matches the gauge theory literature, too, so I think it's right. But let me finish. When the H2 contribution is this thing that I said gets frozen by the fluxes. And that, again, is visible in the F theory just because generic four-form in M theory actually fixes all of the complex structure moduli of the fourfold.
No.
And those include the Higgs branch fields that come from 7 brain charged matter. Okay, let me go on. We can talk it more. Talk about it more afterwards.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So I guess I lost track of that at some moment. But,
okay.
So you are taking flux to be large. So does it mean that the manifold has also large oil number?
Well, by large, all I mean is I took it to be chi over 24 to satisfy that tadpole condition. You don't need that chi over 24 to itself be an extraordinarily large number. What helps you is that the lattice in which the fluxes take values is a big lattice. Okay, so think of the tadpole condition as saying you have a sphere in this flux space, a radius that goes like chi. Then the statement is just that as H3, as the number of different possible fluxes grows, you get a sphere of larger and larger dimension of radius chi. And that's what you use. Not the largeness of chi, but at fixed chi, the way that your sphere has more and more points in it as you increase the number of dimensions. So that's the Busso-Polchinski point. You don't have to go to huge chi at fixed number of fluxes. You have 100 fluxes. Okay. Yeah?
What are the units of sigma? Is it dimensionless, or is it 113
plus units? That's 113 in string units, I think.
So that's pretty small.
It's not huge. It's not huge. It's not a TeV scale manifold. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, the point here is to only tune enough to get to a regime where you trust the calculation, not to tune to a huge manifold, right? Okay. So with these values, for instance, what I called little a times sigma that controls the instanton expansion becomes 10 or 11. So e to the minus a sigma is e to the minus 10. So unless you're very unlucky, you can neglect higher instanton effects. Okay. So this is what I was just saying. This is a genericity statement. In any model, once you have suitably generic superpotential, you will find supersymmetric ADS minima. Okay? And this is already somewhat interesting in that string models with no moduli are not garden variety things, but it seems like they're quite generic, at least in this kind of setup. And actually, I mean, so recently Acharya did some work on things that are rather different in detail, but similar in spirit in G2 manifolds. And I suspect in the heterotic string, you can do some more things.
Remind me, why is it that you generically expect an ADS minimum as opposed to just getting driven off?
It's just counting of equations. So just in supersymmetric field theory, if you have a generic superpotential,
right,
you have n complex equations and n fields.
Yeah. No, but the solution could be at infinity.
That's right, it could be.
And not be ADS. Yeah.
Okay. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Wait, but
you do always have a Minkowski solution, but...
Yeah.
If you can solve the dW equals zero equations at any interior point, it will be an ADS minimum. Right.
Well, okay. No, it has, yeah.
It will be ADS, and it will not decay to infinity because it's ADS. And, okay. Okay. But now we do the messy step. So we're now going to uplift to try and get a De Sitter minimum, which is much harder because we can't have supersymmetry. Okay, and to see how this is possible, I now have to drag in all other kinds of facts about these models, or about specific subclasses of these models. Okay, there are two important facts. The first one is a garden variety fact. The fluxes carry three-brain charge, like D3 brains, and we know well from ADS-CFT that D3 brains warp space-time. And the fluxes enter in a similar way as a source for the gravitational equations, and they warp space-time. So in these models that have a Calabi-Yau with fluxes, the 10 metric is not a trivial product metric. You have the Minkowski metric, in the simplest case, varying by this warp factor as you move around in the Calabi-Yau geometry. So A of Y is what's usually called the warp factor, and G tilde is the Calabi-Yau metric, but the real metric is a warped Calabi-Yau metric, and you have this warp factor. Okay. And I showed in work with Giddings and Polchinski that, roughly speaking, by taking the Klebanov-Strassler solution, for those of you who know what it is, and compactifying it, okay, it is possible, in models of exactly the sort I've been discussing here with all the same properties, okay, to get exponentially large warp factors. That is, to get a situation where the ratio of e to the 2a at some point, why not, as compared to e to the 2a at generic points, goes like some number that's e to the minus k over m, where k and m are two of the flux integers I've chosen, two of the different fluxes of the H and F3 forms through three cycles in the geometry. Okay? And this has a good field theory dual explanation. It's related to RG flow and pure Yang-Mills theory, so there are many ways to understand this exponential. That's one fact. Now, there's a second fact that's important. So far, what we've imagined doing is taking a Calabi-Yau where chi over 24 is H wedge F. We've thrown out the D3 brains entirely. Okay, so we satisfied the tadpole conditions with only fluxes. But you could ask, what if we decided to be overly ambitious, we added too much flux, and then we added a small number, say 1, anti-D3 brain. So we still balance this equation. Okay, so this is a situation I studied with Pearson and Verlinda, and there we were motivated by holography, but we can use it here to add a little bit of energy to our space-time. Okay, the basic point here is that there's lots of D3 charge in this space-time, there are chi units of it, but there are no D3 brains. So although the D3 bar would love to just annihilate a la Sen, it can't because there's nothing for it to annihilate with. Okay. So what it actually has to do is find a way to tunnel to a configuration where it trades itself for some supersymmetric flux and for some D3 brains. And we wrote down a sort of instanton that accomplishes this for you that involves a wrapped NS5 brain. But that's not the important point for us. The important point is that since this is a tunneling process, this gives you a non-supersymmetric metastable state with supersymmetry breaking. Okay. Now, if we hadn't fixed the volume modulus, it would actually be a source of energy density that would cause the volume to decompactify quickly. So you have to make sure that you're adding little enough energy that it doesn't cause the volume to decompactify quickly. How do you do that? Well, where does the D3 bar want to sit? It's not a supersymmetric object in any sense in this background. It feels forces from the fluxes, and the forces quickly suck it to the location of minimal warp factor. You can see that by just using the DBI action. Okay, the ISD fluxes pull it to some particular location. And when it's at that location, what it does is it adds an energy, which is its tension times the warp factor, because its tension gets warped. Okay. And there's this factor of 1 over m rho cubed, because you have to go to Einstein frame correctly, so that's a detail. And there's a factor of 2, because we actually had to add an extra unit of flux, and a very clever analysis by Maldacena and Nastase shows that that just adds a factor of 2 here. Now, the important point here is that although you added energy density, it doesn't have to be a huge effect. It doesn't have to be an m-string to the fourth over g-string kind of effect from the three-brain tension. It has this damping factor due to the warping. So now we have an incredibly complicated picture that looks like this. There's a Calabi-Yau, which is sort of schematically over here. There's this region with the A and B cycles and the units of flux through them that grows you this Klebanov-Strassler-like throat. Okay, so there's exponential warping as you go down this throat region. There's an anti-three brain sitting here at the end of the throat where it's been driven by the fluxes. And then generically, there's all kinds of other stuff in here, including maybe some seven brains over there. Okay. So everything in this picture was present in my construction with Joe and Steve except the anti-three brain sitting there. And we include the kind of correction I talked about before. So what do you get? Well, you just write out the scalar potential. It's not rocket science. So you take the scalar potential we had before. To leading order, you add the energy added by the anti-brain. They communicate in a way that's suppressed by powers of M Planck. So you add a d over sigma cubed, where d is that number that appeared on the previous transparency. It's a power of the warp factor times the tension times 2. Okay. And what you find is if you tune K and M to get the right range for D, okay, you'll get a DS minimum. So in the earlier ADS examples I showed, for D something like that, you get a nice picture that looks like this. Okay, and the only point about this picture is there's a smooth potential. All heights in the region of control are small compared to string scale, and there's a nice healthy DS minimum there. Now, if you fine-tune D, you can obviously get close to zero, or you fine-tune W-naught, but there exists a DS minimum over a wide range of Ds and W-naughts. So if you want to be just below string scale in your energy density, you know, by a factor of only a few thousand and not by 10 to the 120th, that's what it's most convincing that you can arrange, and I think it's quite clear that you can arrange that. Okay. Now, if you really want to take Boussole and Polchinski's kind of idea seriously, in a real model, the typical H3 is greater than 200. They used only 100 fluxes. Here you have a factor of 2 times that. You can try to do some very careful analysis about how well you can fine-tune with such a big lattice, and it actually may be possible to tune enough to get some observably small number. Okay. But I have not checked.
So in this particular case, for example, what are the low energy field content?
In this particular case, it's extremely boring. It would be an abelian gauge boson on the anti-3 brain, which actually undergoes a Myers effect and blows up to a kind of 5 brain. Mm-hmm. And then there would be a bunch of scalars and a confined Yang-Mills theory somewhere in the bulk.
Could there be some large number of slightly massive fields if the chi is large?
There is one effect. Depending on how severe the warping is at the end of the throat, mm-hmm. there could be light strings. Mm-hmm. But we're not taking that to be such a huge effect. So I have no idea how one would really incorporate a standard model. I haven't thought about that kind of thing very much. But this model was designed to have a very boring spectrum.
One obvious suggestion is to have several anti-D3 brains, and then you have gauge dynamics on
those. On those, right.
You say it's blown up, even before it decays, it blows up.
Well, not with one, but if you had several. Then what Herman and I studied was actually first it forms a metastable state where it blows up into a sort of giant graviton 5 brain, uh-huh. and then it decays.
But that could have a very, very long lifetime.
So oh, yeah. No, that lifetime could be plenty long.
Say, as you engage dynamics.
Right. Okay, since I'm close to running out of time, I want to rush through the last bit of my talk. An interesting question is, what is the lifetime of these vacua? I was drawing these simple pictures, and these simple pictures show that although there's a de Sitter minimum, there is a better minimum at infinity, where you just roll off to the standard Dein-Seiberg vacuum. Okay. So let's normalize our field correctly so it has canonical kinetic terms. Then there's some potential that looks like this, roughly. And all I mean to indicate with this is that there's a minimum here, and then you can sort of imagine going off to infinity where there's a lower energy state. Okay. And there's a maximum in between because there has to be by topology, and let's call that phi 1. Okay. Now, how do you estimate the rate with which you hop from here to this better vacuum? Well, there's a standard formalism developed by Coleman and DeLuccia that says the tunneling probability in such a scalar field theory is given by the minus of the Euclidean action for the process, for the solution that sort of takes you here, plus the action for the Euclidean process where you just sit here in this de Sitter space. So that's a Euclidean sphere. Okay, so here I've just said these are the two actions that are relevant. Now, the tunneling action is given by evaluating this function on the trajectory. Okay, this is just the Einstein action coupled to the scalar. And in four dimensions, the trace of Einstein's equation tells you that R is d phi squared plus 4 times V. So if you just plug that into this action, you quickly see that the action just reduces to the integral of V over the trajectory. Okay, that's just an exact statement. That's interesting because in the simplest pictures where the DS minimum is separated from infinity by a single critical point, V is positive on the entire trajectory. So this is the integral of a positive thing. Now, meanwhile, the action, if you just sit in the old minimum, is given by minus 24 pi squared over the potential at the minimum. And if you happen to know about Euclidean quantum gravity, you'll notice that this action is exactly the de Sitter entropy, up to a minus sign, the Gibbons-Hawking entropy for de Sitter space. So the time of decay, which is the inverse of the probability, and this is per unit volume, per unit time, is given by e to the s of phi minus s naught. Well, up here we just argued that s of phi is the minus the integral of a positive definite thing between s and infinity. Okay, so this thing is e to the de Sitter entropy from the e to the minus s naught times something that's exponentially large. Sorry, exponentially small. So the time is exponentially shorter than the recurrence time, the time which is characterized by e to the de Sitter entropy. Okay, and that says that in our models, and in the most generic simple model imaginable, meaning the one with the fewest number of critical points, okay, v will be greater than zero on the trajectory, and you'll always decay exponentially faster than the recurrence time, not because you use some approximate instant time, but just by the analytic form of the Coleman-DeLucia thing. Now, because of the Dein-Seiberg vacuum at infinity being such a generic thing in either the radial direction or the Dilaton direction, this could plausibly always be the case in string theory examples, but it could also not be. Okay, for instance, you can easily imagine an intervening ADS critical point between de Sitter and infinity. Then you're not going to tunnel to infinity by a very straightforward instanton, and you can't use our argument because v does go negative in some region here. Okay. On the other hand, there are more speculative arguments that involve Hawking-Moss instantons or thermal behavior in de Sitter space, and I think Steve will talk about some of these, that say you would still decay faster than the recurrence time because you would fluctuate up to this hill, the top of the hill, and then roll down. So that's plausible but not definitive. Excuse me? I agree. Right. Okay, am I over time or do I have? Oh, good. Okay. Okay. I'll take 2 more minutes and then you guys can argue about. I agree that it's not even obvious that decays from de Sitter to ADS happen. If the de Sitter is low enough, there are regimes where the bubble tension never is defeated by the volume gain. So.
Yeah, but you do have a process of Starobinsky where you fluctuate to the top. And
yeah, that's not decaying to, that's different from decaying to ADS. That's just hopping at the top. That's Hawking Moss. Well, you undergo a big crunch, of course, you don't reach ADS.
Oh, well, that's true.
Anyway. Okay, so let me quickly go through my concluding remarks. We think it is possible to make de Sitter vacua and string or M-theory contrary to existing statements in the literature. Our strategy was to stabilize most of the moduli in a relatively controlled way with fluxes, so that's a subject that's self-contained and you can do things quite rigorously. Okay. Then we get slightly more sloppy and we say, well, there's some simple known non-perturbative effects. It's not hard to imagine incorporating these non-perturbative effects, and the generic incorporation will lead to a supersymmetric ADS vacuum. And then I used some work that I did with Herman and John to argue that it's not hard to think of ways in this class of models to give a little kick to the energy. Okay, if de Sitter space always arises as a metastable state in M-theory, which is not clear, but if it were true, then there shouldn't be a unitary quantum mechanical holographic dual for just a single causal patch of de Sitter space. So one should not worry about that question. There are many obvious directions for further exploration. One is our models are quite ugly. Okay, so is it possible to make something more elegant? I mean, the answer is obviously yes, but you should note that we're not going to look as foolish as we might because the potential elegance is bounded above by the no-go theorems of people like Maldacena and Nunez. Okay, what these say is you have to use one or more of higher derivative corrections to the supergravity action, which we used when we used this Euler character term to add 3 brains, or quantum corrections to the energy, which we used when we used the instanton effect. Okay, so nothing that's as beautiful and elegant as pure Calabi-Yau compactification will work. Okay, are there simple explanations for the de Sitter entropy? Obviously, you're not going to get the numerical prefactor. I have nothing to say about that, but Eva will describe some work she's doing later that might shed some light on that. And the thing that I think is sort of a central question, it's becoming clear, at least to some of us, that we do have to live with a discretium in M-theory. This doesn't mean a supersymmetric moduli space. It means a non-supersymmetric dense set of points, which is really going to be the system of interest. And it seems clear that if such a picture is realized, then something like eternal inflation can happen in string theory, where you start in one of these vacua, it exponentially expands, it decays to other bubbles, but nevertheless, the vacuum you started with, since it's exponentially expanding, continues to exist. And you get one of Andre's pictures of bubbles within bubbles within bubbles. Okay, and what the hell do you do in that kind of system, do you become a meta-observer and ask meta-questions about the full set of bubbles? What are the good questions? And so many people in the Bay Area and elsewhere are thinking about that kind of thing. And I think it's a question we'll have to grapple with sooner or later. Thanks.
Any more questions? So there's sort of Darwinian eternal evolution models where certain things are more favored. Is there any reason why these kind of metastable considered would be favored?
Well, if you imagine that you started with a De Sitter vacuum with generically high cosmological constant close to M string, then in some cases what is true is that at very late times, I'm assuming a little bit here, but I think it's true, at very late times, you can have a static distribution of the probability per unit physical volume that you're in a certain kind of vacuum. This distribution would in no sense favor a very small cosmological constant, but it gives you some kind of thing you could compute. Of course, the highest cosmological constant always wins in a Darwinian sense. It wins by volume. Even though it decays quickly, it expands even more quickly. So I don't think there will be, if that's what you meant by Darwinian, that doesn't sound very promising for explaining where we live.
Yeah, but again, that's sort of based on a completely classical argument, just like the one that Augustine and Nunez based their argument.
You're right. That's just saying, well, it expands exponentially, it decays with some rate. So maybe string theory changes that.
I mean, these discussions can be taken in interesting directions. You could try to claim that the vacuum with a low cosmological constant, which is closest, you know, easiest to produce from this guy with the highest cosmological constant, is disabled more. And so there would be some difficult but possible computation you could do someday. And then the other thing you can always say is that, well, you know, so what? You know, if we check that universe and it's not the one we live in, then there's really nothing to say. You know, any such argument can only be suggested.